Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We've been told from the beginning of this event that a deal is imminent, and there's no deal. At what point do people just start ignoring what tweets come out of the White House or Axios with, you know, them seeming to push the propaganda?
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome, a very special welcome to this episode of Finance U. We have a lot to discuss today, and back with me is Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing good, Chris. Having a good time during these very interesting times that we live in.
Sure thing. So here's what I'd like to talk about today is going to be, well, we're in the midst of the largest energy shock ever, but you wouldn't know it, Paul, from our markets, from the behavior of oil is very different. You know, there's this old saying that we used to have back in the day when I was a trader, right? I did a lot of trading, which was you buy the rumor, sell the news.
Yep.
Okay. Oil's different. Oil is selling the rumor. I think it's going to buy the news. I actually think when they announced that the strait is finally open, and we'll talk about that in just a second, how open is it? Not very. But every time there's a hint of it being open, there's just like this massive wall of selling in oil. So they're selling the rumor. Now, when it finally does open, I think the reality sets in. People are like, oh, this is kind of a hot mess.
Right.
Of course it is. But it's behaving very bizarrely. I'm watching very seasoned oil traders and longtime market participants really scratching their heads going, this is not how this is supposed to work. This is bizarre, this stage.
You know, somebody mentioned it a week or two ago, said sell the tweet and buy the reaction, right? So the tweet drives the prices down and then buy the reaction depending upon how fast you move. And I thought that's just kind of bizarre how this market environment is, because fundamentals don't matter, because there's so much propaganda and effort being put into keeping those prices down and draining our strategic petroleum reserves.
Yeah.
Not a lot makes sense.
No, it doesn't. I was on a number of interviews over this past few days, and you know, the phrase I'm using is the fog of diplomacy, supposed to be the fog of war. I've never been through a thing like this. Marco Rubio, ostensibly the State Department head, isn't saying anything at all. Every so often he comes out and says, oh, there could be progress soon. But otherwise, this whole thing is being driven by tweets and statements through unofficial sources and places like Telegram. So it's the bizarre. It's foggy. Here we are on May 27th. It's Wednesday afternoon, and this just came out from the Kobesi letter. Breaking: Iranian state media announces initial details of the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding. And I want to note what's missing from this. So here's what they said. They said military forces will withdraw from the vicinity of Iran. The Navy will lift its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has committed to restoring the number of commercial transit ships through the Strait of Hormuz to pre-war levels within 1 month. Boom. Oil just went cratering on that news. Iranian state media says military vessels not included in this draft agreement. So sorry, U.S. military. We, you know, some of our largest bases, the Bahrain, the Fifth Fleet's headquarters was in Bahrain. That got pretty messed up with Iranian missiles. But the idea that Iran's going to say is part of the MOU, no more U.S. ships, military ships in the Gulf? Quite a thing. I can't imagine the U.S. ever agreeing to this. And they say the management and routing of ship traffic through the Strait of Hormuz will be handled by Iran in cooperation with Oman. They're going to charge, not tolls, environmental fees. That's what they're calling them.
They're learning.
Yeah. And six, if a final deal is reached within 60 days, this agreement will be approved in a binding UN Security Council resolution. And boom. But look, no Lebanon, no restitution, no nuclear anything, no unfreezing of funds. This looks like, what am I even reading here, right, at this point in time? So it's bizarre that Iranian state media would come out with something that leaves off all of their main points down below. And so agreeing with us, me here, is Piper Sandler, Tracy Shuhart on Twitter today, putting out that the Strait of Piper Sandler, the research firm, says that Strait of Hormuz is going to remain closed for months to oil, and oil's going to hit new highs. And they aren't buying the talk that Iran deal is nearing. They're telling clients the Strait of Hormuz will largely stay closed and oil will hit new highs. Quote, we think the Strait of Hormuz remains largely closed for months yet, meaning shortages become more urgent and oil hits new highs this summer. So that's according to the investment bank's energy and macro teams. So I don't think there's no deal. And since there's no deal, this energy crisis is just barely getting started. And I think we have to be prepared for vastly higher energy prices based on what we're seeing today. What do you think?
No, I completely agree. I mean, with the backdrop of inflation already running hotter and surging, I mean, and, you know, this is just, it's coming. The question is why is the market really not paying any attention? The market seems to be paying more attention to the propaganda and the tweets, everything in the short run. And maybe the market's just refusing to believe that they're going to allow this to happen, right? And the question is, can they control it? Because you've got two parties that are in there. So we're setting up for some major surprises and shocks. And like you've talked about several times over the past couple of months, the normal demand destruction by allowing prices to go higher means that it's going to be an absolute baseball bat to the face to the average person who has no clue what's going on because the propaganda is keeping them in the dark. You know, and sure, there's a possibility that maybe this all works out and they thread this needle perfectly, right? Like, I mean, a 100-mile shot that hits, you know, bullseye, it's possible, but it's highly unlikely at this point with the information that's out there. And big firms like Piper Sandler, I mean, they've got major resources that they put onto this. And they're not going to just go out and make up some story to meet some narrative on the other side. They're looking at the facts of the data like you are and saying this is a train wreck coming unless some miracle comes out of the blue. And look, I mean, how many times on a daily basis, well, weekly basis, when oil either breaks out or yields break out, have we been told that we're going to have a deal? I mean, we've been told from the beginning of this event that a deal is imminent, and there's no deal. At what point do people just start ignoring what tweets come out of the White House or Axios with, you know, them seeming to push the propaganda?
Yeah, with the former Mossad agent Barak Ravind writing the articles, it's a little suspicious. In fact, there are three parties in this. Of course, Israel's a party too, in a very realistic sense. So, look, this energy shock is just getting started, and we're starting to see the ripples come through. You mentioned inflation, and you and I are going to talk about that at some later point. And the Financial Times, sorry, it's a little blurry. I'll read it for you. They just on their headline. Just this morning said, Iran energy shock starts to squeeze real wages in world's rich countries, which is a fancy, long way of saying inflation. Squeezing real wages. Yeah, prices are going up. We can simplify that because that's what we do at Finance. You make it easy. So already, though, we're starting to see that real impact. It's really people are really starting to get hit and are starting to notice. And of course, we just came through a really punishing round of inflation with COVID. And we have another one coming. And yeah, we just have to get ready for that. But it's rooted in this energy shock. That's where this is coming from.
Yes. And
can't print your way out of this one, I don't think.
No, I don't think they can. I mean, supply demand, but it is pretty simple from the standpoint, let's assume this continues. That's less oil. More money being printed just means more money chasing less supply, which is going to further exacerbate the price. And let's say maybe they can use the options market and derivatives to try to artificially hold that price down. Then the consequences of that breaking, if they, you know, are unable to pull it off, is going to be much more severe if they just allow this to start unfolding in a natural manner and let people adapt to it instead of just, you know, baseball bat to the face, which is what it looks like it's coming. But at the same time, Chris, I'll tell you, the handwriting's been on the wall for quite some time, and the evidence just continues to build. But it's really hard for people. That's one thing I've learned in 28 years of being in this industry. When the media and the propaganda, the thing about propaganda is it works, right? What was it? Hitler, again, I'll butcher this, said, you tell a lie loud enough and long enough, people start to believe it. I mean, that propaganda, the constant, you know, information coming in and then looking, and it's like, well, they've been warning me that prices are going to move, but they're not. So people just start to tune it out and they go on about their day, which is much more severe in the impact if they're not able to actually control this and keep it from happening. And that's the hard part, because if you're looking at the math like you are, it's like, I'm having to fight complacency from the standpoint of, look, I'm not saying I'm getting complacent, but you have to fight that. Well, does it really matter? Because it does. The weight of the information on a scale of, you know, will it happen or not, is just continuing to weigh that this is a riskier and riskier situation by the week.
Well, indeed, you know, Paul, they're doing everything they can at this point to evade reality, right? Let's just ignore it. So one of the things they've been doing, and I just keep screaming about this, I can't believe we're doing this. This is the drawdowns in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve of the United States. And you can see here, this is the Biden years where it was the Strategic Political Reserve. They dumped it to try and, you know, into the 2022 election cycle. But also remember, 2022 was kind of a perilous year, stocks and bonds, liquidity crisis. They were doing everything they could just to ease conditions, right, coming into that. So that was this. This is totally unprecedented. These are the largest two, you know, weeks of drawdowns, and they're just building, right? It's just getting more and more and more. And so that's what we're doing in the United States. We're funding the world's oil demand from the SPR. And here's the problem, Paul. We talk about this all the time. The reason that we have to put so much out there is because demand is up here and supply. So we're just bringing supply up to demand, when instead we need prices to go up to bring demand back down to supply. But they don't want to do that for some reason. I don't know. It's political. They're worried about it financially. I don't know. But
right,
our prices are being artificially held down somehow. And it's, I know that because demand can't be above supply in something like oil for long, right?
No.
That just becomes a huge, huge crisis over time. So, well, people have asked me this, Paul, like how long can they do that? So the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR, the floor is about 150 million barrels. Currently, there's 365 million barrels in there, right? And you can see it here over time, starting in the 80s. And they were supposed to be holding it at about 700 million barrels. China's is twice that. So we could argue if this is even sufficient. But that would have been sort of where we would want to hold it. We're obviously less than half that. This got all drawn down, started to rebuild it. Bang, it's just coming back down again. So if there's 365 million barrels in there, that means that there's about 215 million barrels more to go before there's absolutely no more. Like, you just can't draw it down any further. So that could be 158 days. That could get us close to the end of the year. But then we hit the wall, Paul, at full speed, right? That would be a really dumb thing to do. In fact, if I wanted to wreck the country, that's exactly what I would do. I would just apply every financial shenanigan, dump the SPR, and then I would have the country just hit a supply crisis at full speed. That would be very damaging.
Well, and look, if I'm our enemies, I'm going to jawbone and I'm going to give you a little bit of hope, and I'm going to drag this out as long as possible and try to build some relationship with others. Because if we do draw that down in the next 158 days and this is still going on, and we're in a position to hit that wall, what happens all of a sudden now if we've realized that we've been played and they've built other individuals that says, hey, look, you've been the bully around the world, so we're just going to cut your supply off and you can rely on what you have. And you've explained that, yeah, we may be a net exporter, but we can't refine everything that we need in the country. So we're putting ourselves in a very weak position from a long-term standpoint for what? Political gains in the short run? And even the polling numbers don't show that it's working on the average individual. So I wish we were focused more on the long-term instead of instant gratification and political narrative at this point.
Oh, indeed. And, you know, if we said there's some amount of time out there, by the way, this is just the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR. But if we look at total crude stockpiles, so this is crude, this is in commercial stocks. So commercial, you know, you got your Valero refinery, it's got all those tanks outside the refinery. There's oil in there, various levels. So when you add all of that up, those are called commercial inventories, to the SPR, these are years starting from 2010, progressing so all the way to 2026. So we got 16 years of data here. We are now plumbing the lowest it's ever been, ever, in the last 16 years, okay? And some of these years that we're comparing it against are a long time ago. So it's not, you know, yes, there's 820 million barrels in there sounds like a lot, but it's not, because there's a minimum that they can operate at before. You can't use all 800, right? Some of them, there's tank bottoms or sediment down there. There's pipeline fills. There's reasons you can't go all the way down. We don't know what the super lowest part is, but it's getting there. So this right here, this is pretty aggressive decline, especially for this time of year. And so that's, you could say, well, where does this get serious? I don't know. You have to continue drawing this line. I don't know, July, August, points down here at the 700 mark. I think that's where things get dicey. But then we could also look at gasoline on top and diesel down below. And you see here that red line, this is headed the wrong direction coming into the summer driving season for gasoline. Diesel is at the very, very bottom of the last 16 years of range. Can't go a lot lower. So, but we've been exporting it like crazy to help the rest of the world not have to feel the pinch from the Gulf being, the Strait of Hormuz being closed down in the Persian Gulf. We can't do this forever. And we're just sort of pretending like we can do this forever. And the markets are pretending like we can do this forever. And we can't do this forever. And so when this bites, Paul, it's going to be pretty dramatic, I think.
Yes. And I think it's going to happen so fast that only those that are prepared for it are going to be able to adapt quick enough. Prepared and aware of this information to adapt quick enough to get a really bad smack on their hand instead of losing a couple of limbs.
So that's the energy shock. Wanted to bring that to you. Paul, you know what I'd really like to talk about at this point? Can we talk about this money flood? We got to talk about the money flood. So here's the thing. People are like, oh, you know, stocks are up. You know, it says something, right? It means something. But when we're honest about this, this isn't a U.S. money flood. This isn't a U.S. AI story. This isn't just the big seven. You and I have talked about this before. But here we're looking at the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, then the Nikkei, Japanese stocks, Euro stocks, 50, self-explanatory, NASDAQ 100, and the German DAX. Every single one of these, Paul, is at or right near, I think German DAX is just poking at its all-time highs ever. So this is worldwide. This is Japan, Europe, Germany, U.S., big tech, small tech, no tech, doesn't matter what we're talking about. It's an absolute. So this is a money flood. And this money flood obviously kicked off after that April taper tantrum thing, tariff tantrum that we had beginning of 2025. And it's just been off to the races. So this speaks, Paul, to a massive global money flood. That's what this says to me. And it's independent of country at this point. It's pretty massive.
Yeah, it seems to be all the Western countries. And the most dangerous part is you've got this massive money flood that appears to be out there from all the data that we're seeing, with the addition of the markets being turned into a casino with all the zero-day options, the gambling, and the max euphoria, which happens at these parts of cycles. So you've got this perfect storm right now that's setting up to make it impossible to know when this ends. You know, it could end 2 days from now. It could end 2 years from now. But the longer it lasts, the more damage it's going to do to the average person on the other side, because they're fully convinced that you know, the easy liquidity, the euphoria that's behind, that they are the next Warren Buffett, but they have no risk management skills. They have no exit skills. They're really skilled at speculating and thinking they're investing.
Now, you and I talked about this last time, that bonds obviously are selling off, and we have some more data on that later. Might be in a slightly different segment here. But in the United States, remember we had the bad old 2022s? That was a terrible time. We had negative money growth. Oh, remember that? Stocks and bonds down like horror. That was bad.
Yep.
So they freaked out. And ever since then, it's been a wall of green. And it's just been money supply growth is just growing, 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 growing. And that's the U.S. side. This comes from Tavi Costa. I got it off of his Twitter handle. And here's also from Tavi Costa. Look at global money supply, Paul. Plus 17 trillion since the beginning of 2025 to now. So that's a year and a half, $17 trillion in the global system. And they're not buying bonds. In fact, they're walking away from bonds. What's left? Equities, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Where do you put $17 trillion? You know?
Well, I mean, it's just driving asset price inflation. I mean, across the board it is. I mean, the more money that's out there with limited assets, then that's driving those prices up. And I think everybody's been chasing momentum stocks. It seems to be chasing the AI trade right now. You look at how large a percentage of the S&P 500 that is. But as the bond market starts to crack, and especially if they step in there with yield curve control and all that, I do believe, and we're already seeing in our money flow indicators, that commodities, emerging markets, those, and especially specifically emerging markets, a lot of them are related to commodity production, so they benefit with higher commodity prices. We're starting and to continue to see money flow into those directions in big numbers, which is telling us that big institutions are saying, hey, if this continues, we won't own real assets more so than the shiny assets of the market. And your typical modern portfolio theory, passive investing, is not going to make that adaptation soon enough to protect their purchasing power. So I think it's going to ultimately ridiculously benefit commodities in general and emerging markets because of the pressure that's going to put on the U.S. dollar at some point.
Well, this M2 is principally, that's bank lending. When we're talking about this, where did that $17 trillion come from? Well, that's mostly banks lending for whatever reasons, right? Also, it's governments borrowing, right? So of that $17 trillion in global new liquidity, taking it from 105 to 121 trillion, we have to, from 2025, that's at least $4 trillion of U.S. government debt is part of that equation, because that borrowing ends up showing up in the money supply. And, of course, the headwaters of the money supply picture is the Federal Reserve here, and they've printed $178 billion over the past 176 days from December 3rd to now. Oh, last reading, 520, May 20th. So that's $178 billion in 176 days. So that's a billion a day. It's just a billion a day. Just a little taste, a little something-something for the markets. The Fed is going to be out here talking about how is it time to cut rates or raise rates. Or irrelevant. They're printing money, right? A billion a day. A billion a day. Paul, when I came across this, though, because I'm putting all this together, I'm like, where's all this money? What is this money flood? What is it? I hadn't really digested this till I got in here. And so this is money market funds. So total level, right? So let's just start. I think the first money market funds opened about 1980, right? And by about 1998 or so, it crossed their first trillion. And then by 2000, oops, but it fell back a little bit. It hit $2 trillion by, 2005. Then, great financial crisis, boom, right up here, touches $4 trillion, settles back, $3 trillion, $3 trillion, $3 trillion, $3 trillion, until right here at about 2018-19, boom, puts $2 trillion on from 3 to 5, and then sort of parks along at 5 for a second. This is the second quarter of 2022 where I said, this is where they started freaking out. Look at this, Paul. $3 trillion new dollars in money market funds. $3
trillion. Incredible.
In just...
It's incredible.
Basically 4 years.
60% increase in all of that period of time happens in that short a period. That's incredible.
Where's this coming from? Where is all this money coming from?
I mean, they're not telling us that they're QE. That's a good question where that's coming from.
But there it is. So, and of course, money market funds, huge part of the liquidity of the system. Most of those are housed in things like corporate bonds, treasury bonds, sometimes agency bonds. But for the most part, this is a story of the U.S. government needed to start parking a lot of treasury money, bonds somewhere, and money market funds stepped right up. Now, I'm going to show you a little piece. We're going to talk about a piece of that later. It's kind of arcane. It's about the basis trade. Anyway, we'll talk about, something changed here. I just want to be cognizant of that. Something drastically changed. This is the sharpest, fastest increase in money market fund. $3 trillion. It's a not insignificant number. That's a
massive number.
And you put it all together, and what's the incentive to print? Well, obviously, the Fed really likes assets, in particular, likes the stock market going up and to the right. And here we're looking at global M2. That's broad money. Lagged by about 11 weeks, so broad money sloshes into the market 11 weeks later. The stock market response, boing, and it's very tight correlation. So this suggests that, all you have to do is really keep your eye on M2. And it's growing like crazy. So money flood. Now, obviously, this creates excitement because you get stocks going up, Paul, but you also get more and more people reporting that they can't afford to live anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, and that's real pain that people are experiencing right now. I mean, that is real pain. And I mean, it's amazing to me because I've heard conversations around the edges when I'm out in places of just how expensive things are. And we don't want to travel as much because it's just getting, you know, one, it's a nightmare to get through security and everything involved and just how expensive things are. So that's a more common conversation everywhere I go. And I'm usually pretty sensitive to pick up on those when I hear them. But this is something that started at the corner of cocktail parties 6 months ago that's now the center of conversation
right.
for the average individual. Now, those in the top 5, 10%, they mention it, but their lifestyles aren't being changed. The average person and what is traditionally your middle class is really starting to make some behavior changes because of these price pressures. Mm-hmm. And why are they continuing that, right? 11-week league? That puts you pretty dang close to the election cycle. Is this all just a political event? You know, we're going to cause a lot of pain for a lot of people to help us politically in the short run. I don't know why. There's no reason to be printing money at that rate. And if you're serious about getting rid of inflation, then you need to be reducing the money supply in some manner. Keep rates the same, but keep quantitative tightening instead of quantitative easing. But that's not going to help the political outcome in the short run. So is that really what this boils down to? It sure seems to be.
It could be, you know. And speaking of behavior changes, right, you know, we've talked about this before. What do you need for a bubble? I argue that we're just a vicious bubble. Take a look at the stock price. And by the way, Paul, if I ever mention a specific stock, I'm obviously not making a recommendation for or against any particular share. And, of course, I will never give out anything like stock tips or anything. You know, there's a lot of fraud out there right now, so sometimes when we post things to YouTube or I put them up on Twitter, you get these bots that show up and say, you know, I'm Chris Martinson, follow me for stock tips. I never do that. Just want to be crystal clear about that. I know you never do that either. So, I mean, hopefully that's obvious, but I just, there's just so many scams out there, right?
Yeah, you just have to be diligent for everything, right?
Yeah, for everything. So with that said, if you looked at the stock price of Micron, you know, ticker MU, literally straight up, you know. You have to put it on a log chart and it still bends up, you know. It's crazy, right? That's a bubble, right? And so what do you need for a bubble? You need a good story and you need ample credit. Those are those two things. It's all you need, right? Everything over your head there, right? They started lending against tulip bulbs, right? You know, great story, tulip bulbs, credit, you know, railroads, good story. Credit. Yeah, it's every single time. So with that said, have you seen this chart of margin debt? You know,
it's insane. Yes,
margin debt. So these are people borrowing or individuals or entities borrowing in order to bet or speculate or buy stocks with leverage in the stock market. Typically about you need to have 50% margin in reserve against. You can borrow up to 50% of the value, but that means you can double. You can double your holding size, right? If I had 100 shares, I could go on margin and acquire 200 shares, right, of something. So, but this is 5.3% of GDP. It's never been higher compared to GDP. Obviously, as an aggregate number, 1.3 trillion. Woo! But look at it of late. This most recent behavior here. Again, this is incredible, unbelievable. Puts the dot-com bubble to shame.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
sheer panic, fear of missing out, lever to the hilt, gambling is what it is. And even within there, you can see it's not a rhythmic cycle, but you can see peaks and troughs and peaks and troughs. But again, you go after 2008, you know, the Feds, you know, fueled this speculative behavior. And now they've finally convinced the average person to throw out any historical wisdom and just pile all in.
Yep.
Right.
Just pile all in. Wow. It's really something. It's really, wow. It's amazing. So
that's mind boggling. Sorry. I was going to say, and Chris, here's the thing. People are using it to buy real estate with cash. They're, you know, some of it's not just levering up on their investments. It's like, well, I don't want to pay capital gains. So I'm going to borrow against my stocks and I'm going to go buy this or I'm going to buy cars. There's rippling into all kinds of other areas, but people forget Like, look, if you've got 50% margin on there, not only do you have the carrying rate, but if you do have a reversion in the market, which was normal historically from our levels, that's a 50% decline. Now, all of a sudden, it's forced liquidation if you don't have the money to reduce that, and you lose your entire position, right? So, I mean, it is a highly speculative way to invest, and it's just another mile marker that's a signs of the times of the part of the cycle that we're in.
Yeah, just to put, this is a little wonky, but we'll talk people through it, because this also explains just how much liquidity is out there. In this case, the Fed's printing, banks are lending, people are borrowing on margin. I mean, it's just like a unbelievable free-for-all, and one measure of that is this, which is a little wonky. So the SOFR, so this is the Secured Overnight Funding Rate. So banks, if you're a bank, I'm a bank, we lend to each other overnight, right? Sounds kind of short-termish, but there's reasons they need to do that for capital cushions and sufficiency and things, right? So you might have a little extra cash and you're like, you know what? I don't need it tonight. I'll lend it to Chris and I'll borrow it for the night, give it back in the morning, right? So that's the overnight, and it's secured. So these are probably secured with something, some asset I've got, usually treasuries, right? So it's secured. And then there's the Fed funds rate, which, you know, if you're a big bank, I'm a big bank, we can just park our money at the Fed. You know, you get this Fed funds rate, right? They're offering you something. And the Fed's pretty guaranteed to you. You're not going to lose your money at the Fed, right? So it's good, stuff. So normally you will find that when you subtract the Fed funds from the secured overnight funding rate, you're left with a positive number of some kind, right? Because we're charging each other more than the Fed might charge us. If the Fed's number is larger, we go below zero. It's unusual. It happens, but it's unusual. Look at this period right here. This is huge. Like, and it just says when we're above the zero, things are tight. Cash situation, liquidity in the system's tight. When we're below, it's loose. And this is really loose. We have just cash, so much cash pouring out there. Paul, you're like, Chris, I'll lend it to you overnight for 10 basis points less than I can get from the Fed. Not worth my trouble. Here. How much do you need, good sir?
Yeah.
You know?
And easy money and easy credit is going to continue to fuel inflation.
So, at any rate, this is about as loose as I've seen things in a long time. It's just, you know, but you can, of course, you can see that in the behavior of stocks, right? The mystery man out at this party, of course, is oil, which just seems to want to go down as often as possible. And also very mysterious to me, Paul, that gold and silver basically have gone nowhere. We're at basically 4,400 to 4,600 on gold since the war started. It doesn't really go up or down. Silver hangs around 75 plus or minus two, doesn't really go anywhere. And that's a mysterious thing to me when we look at A, geopolitical risk, B, this amount of inflation and all this pumping that's happening normally would be pretty constructive for your average commodities out there. C, because we are seeing the commodity indexes start to turn up, right? And D, because we're seeing inflation show up across the board. Well, price hikes, which doesn't, well, this is, inflation's a monetary phenomenon. We also have some supply issues, but you put the two together, you get sort of inflation on steroids. So that's kind of it is a mystery to me how our markets are behaving right now, given this that we just talked about.
It really is. And this is where an investor just has to be patient, right? And disciplined. When you look at the weight of the information, you got to be patient until the information changes so that the seeds of whatever is causing it, whether it's the hidden hand that's holding it down. We've seen that they lost their grip for a period of time when we had some breakouts and then that big move. For whatever reason, either investors are directed chasing semis and the AI theme right now, that's peeling a tremendous amount of money over that way and momentum's moving that way. So there seems that lack of momentum in the metal space and commodities, right, chasing it over in the semis allows, if there is that hidden hand, to keep those prices controlled a little bit better without being overwhelmed.
Well, isn't that interesting? So I invite everybody, you know, keep your eye on the money flood. It's actually one of the key indicators I'm looking at to just understand where things are going. And if M2 ever starts to fall, look out below, right? But I don't, it's not happening so far. and probably won't, given all the borrowing that's happening to construct data centers willy-nilly. That's hundreds of billions of dollars of debt in outstanding, which helps the M2 supply just keep growing and growing. All right.
It's a big flood.
It is biblical. So we're talking about where is all this money coming from? And there's a little bit of a mystery here, and it's a tiny bit wonkish, but I think it's really important, and I want to go through this with people. So the Cayman Islands, it's an offshore money center, right? So most hedge funds, if they want to be domiciled outside of the U.S. for tax reasons, for other reasons, they get a post office box in a building down in the Cayman Islands. Honestly, they're not there. They're probably in New York or Palm Beach, right? But technically, they're domiciled there. So the Cayman Islands becomes a place where we see things stacking up. And this was a fascinating paper. Came out in October of 2025. I don't think we went through it. I've referenced it a couple times. I thought, let's take people through it because it's really astonishing. This was really quite shocking. It's got some very bland Federal Reserve sort of speak in this. It was put together by Barth, Beltran, Hoops, Kahn, Liu, and Perozek. Good paper, too. They say, introduction, quote, recent regulatory data collections on hedge funds indicate a massive increase in Cayman Islands hedge fund exposures to U.S. Treasury securities over the last 2 years, corresponding to a simultaneous surge in hedge funds, treasury cash, futures, basis trade positions. We'll talk about what that is, the basis trade. Okay, and so, you know, all this other data, they say here, statistics from the U.S. Treasury International Capital, the TIC report, data do not show a significant increase in treasury securities held by the Cayman Islands hedge funds. Huh. That's really weird. Because, Paul, I would think that if I own a U.S. Treasury, okay, the U.S. Treasury has to know who to send the coupon payment to, right?
Right.
They have to know that, right? There has to be an account associated with that in some way, shape, or form. So I always assume they just pressed some buttons and said, where's all this paper being held? Second, when an offshore entity holds U.S. Treasury paper like China, they don't actually get a piece of paper. They actually have an accounting entry that actually is held in custody at the New York Federal Reserve. China doesn't actually have them. They're held in a custody account. It belongs to China, just totally not entirely theirs. So when we looked at the most recent, one of the TIC reports here, Cayman Islands has about $427 billion of U.S. Treasury paper. That's what they said. And then this study comes along and says, did we say 427? We actually meant $1.85 trillion. They were missing $1.4 trillion, and they got those off of the form PFs from the filings, from the hedge fund's filings. They just dug through and said, how many pieces of treasury paper do you think you hold? Paul, how do you miss $1.4 trillion of ownership in this system? How is that even a thing?
There's no way you can miss that much in the system. That has to be an intentional missing for some reason. But why would they intentionally obfuscate or hide that data? Do you have a theory on that?
Well, it could be. There's some mechanism to this. So let's talk about the basis trade real quick, and so people have a grounding in that, and then I'll tell you what I think is happening here. So this is the basis trade. So there's a difference between the futures price. Let's say this is futures for a T-bill, and it's in a year from now, okay? It expires in a year. So you could sell the futures for $100, right? But then you could buy the underlying cash bond for actually $99.50. So there's a gap there. So you short the future, you long the bond. It's a long short trade, right? I buy the bond and then I sell this future out into the market. And then I wait over time, those two prices come together and if all goes according to plan and something doesn't blow up on me, I'm going to pick up this 50 basis points here, right? 0.5%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when it turns out that the gross short position treasury futures, so they're selling the futures again, is $1.2 trillion. Paul, if I'm short a trillion and I pick up 50 basis points, that's $50 billion. And it's basically
a huge amount of money.
It's a huge amount of money. $50 billion is a lot for anybody, right?
Yeah.
So it's always possible, like, you know, where do you come up with a trillion, right? And we're talking about where did all this M2 growth come from? I think this is what's happening. I think that the hedge fund would like buy all these, they're buying all this treasury paper, but you don't have all that money kicking around. But now you have treasury paper. So you actually finance that by having a big bank give you money, and then you give them the treasuries to hold as collateral.
Okay.
Even though you're in the Cayman Islands, it's actually, I don't know that those bonds ever went anywhere, right? They might be domiciled in New York with J.P. Morgan in a collateral account or some kind. But that means that there's just, this represents another infinite money glitch for the U.S. government, which is running $2 trillion plus a year, and it has to find purchasers. That's what I've been struggling with. That's why I went down this path. Paul, I've been wondering, where is all this money coming from? Why is M2 growing so quickly? Where is all this? And it turns out it's from this kind of stuff, the sophisticated financial markets, the basis trades, right?
The financialization of the markets, right?
Yep.
Leverage on top of leverage on top of leverage.
Right.
Now, if I remember correctly, Sam Bankman-Fried, he operated out of the Caymans, didn't he?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. So there must be a reason to operate there.
Kind of a Wild West.
Sorry, I couldn't help it.
But the point here is, Paul, this is all fun and games on the way up, right? So we see all these spiking thises and thats, right? Stock market, money floods, you know, printing, liquidity, basis trades, trillions. It's all fun until it turns course on you. And when it does, it actually is just as much unfun in reverse as it was fun in the way up. You know, it's just this is sowing the seeds for pretty intense destruction. What's fascinating is watching how this all turned around in 2022 here.
Yeah,
that's somebody got freaked out and did a little something behind the scenes, and we just watched an unbelievable flood of money come into everything since then.
And you can see it, the inflationary pressures, the asset price movements. I mean, you can see it across the board, even with the underlying economic data starting to creak and pop, as you've said, or deteriorate, but yet the headline seems to be operating just fine. So this big ball of money keeps finding its way into areas that help, you know, kind of fog the reality of what's taking place for the average individual who's doesn't have somebody that's warning them, or they're just not paying attention because they're living their lives and they're trusting what they've been told is operating the way it should.
So for me, to answer the question then, is this time different? I have to believe that somehow the money masters have figured out this infinite money glitch, and they found an easy way to just keep more and more money flowing into the system. Now, they do that, Paul, and you know this, and I know this, because we don't live in these in that tiny bubble that these people inhabit. These policies of theirs keep things limping along by appearances, but so this is a conversation I have all the time, Paul. Like, people used to like really struggle at 50,000 family income. Then it was 75. I can talk to people now who are earning 150 to 200 living in cities, and they're like, Chris, I'm not living extravagantly. I'm actually living exactly the same as I was 2 years ago, only I could make it 2 years ago. Now I'm barely hanging on, right? Because all these cost pressures have come up. That's what this creates for us. An explicit policy to rob everybody to pay Paul.
And it happens slowly at first. You know, after the 2008 crisis, it started happening slowly. But now we're to the point that they can't hide it anymore, but they're continuing the same policies. And the average person is starting to wake up to the reality of, hey, something doesn't make sense to me right now. You know, and they're having to learn really, really quickly. And once you see it, you cannot unsee it. It's like those fuzzy pictures, right? You know, that they used to be years ago at the beach. You cross your eyes just the right way and something would jump out at you. You know, once you learn how to see that, you can't unsee it on any of those that you come through. And you know, my question is what happens when we reach a mass of people realizing what these policies are? How are we going to swing politically? Are we going to swing all the way back to the Mondamis, right? Which is not the answer. That's just going to make it worse. Or is there going to be some demand of destruction? People just quit trying to play the game in any manner they can. But the problem is, Chris, this is what we struggle with all the time. I have conversations with people. Well, I had one with somebody yesterday. It's like, I'm terrified of the markets. They're like, we're thrilled. Returns have been great, you know, for their particular time that we've been working together. I think I can say that. But anyway, you know, they're like, should I just park it on the sidelines? I'm like, no, you can't, right? You can be neutral, but it's dangerous to choose to be completely bearish And it's just as dangerous to choose to be completely bullish, because you got to be adaptive in this environment, because we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us, because we don't have the power to change them. And we've got to play the cards that we're dealt as best we can and understand it's not going to be perfect, because this is a completely different environment we find ourselves in now than what we've seen, you know, over the past decade, really.
Well, we've just been trying to unravel the mysteries, like, where is all this money coming from? And I feel like that picture you talked about is starting to come into focus for me. And it's no one thing. It's not just the Fed printing. It's the basis trades. It's the M2 growth explosion because we're lending to data centers. It's the margin borrowing. But it's everything at once. And that makes this an exceptionally difficult, challenging environment. Because like you say, you can't afford not to play the game because this inflation is going to eat you alive. I deplore that. Forces people to have to take risks, right? You can't not play the game, even if you say, I'd rather not. It's they make it all but impossible, right?
You know? They do.
So,
and I'll add another thing on top of that, Chris, to the list that you already put out there, is the derivatives market. The derivatives market is everywhere now. So what's happening with these options is options flows are forcing dealers to hedge flows, which is forcing others to hedge flows, and it just compounds on top of itself. But the problem is, when it turns the other way, whenever that does happen, it's going to create the opposite effect just as powerfully as what we've seen on the top side. And in the background, you know, Mike Green's done a great job of talking about passive investing and how that impacts the market. At some point, the large asset holders of the baby boomers are going to have to start drawing more out and turn into net liquidators. And then that's going to completely change the reaction of the markets from what we've seen here. It'll be the opposite side of the coin.
Well, I thought we should discuss the basis trade here so that, you know, maybe we could understand one of the dials that gets turned in this story. It's pretty shocking, really, to me.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, let's talk about inflation. I say inflation inbound. That's a lie. It never left. This just came out in the Financial Times through March of 2026, showing that the Fed has this 2% inflation target, which I will tell you, even that's an abomination. Why not zero? Why not minus 2%? Like they just announce it like, oh, we're trying to achieve a 2% inflation target. Why? Why do you want to constantly nibble at my money all the time, right? They never answer that. And our erstwhile reporters never ask them the questions like, yay, timeout. Why? Why is 2% inflation important? Of course, they would have to answer the question. The answer is well, that helps alleviate the debt burdens that are already out in the system. Like, yeah, but then that causes debts to grow even bigger. Yeah, but then we'll alleviate those. It's like this never-ending cycle. But anyway, they've missed their red line 2% inflation target badly. And here we see this is the COVID inflation. That stank, right? But the current pace right here, this upturn right here, this is as steep as it's been at any point in time. We are now turning the corner, coming into another period of fairly high inflation. You and I have talked about how this very, very much mirrors the inflation from the 70s through the early 80s. We're mirroring here today that earlier inflation in the 70s is a dark blue line. The green line is showing us where we are in the CPI, Consumer Price Index, here in green. And you can see we've started to turn the corner. That's about to get worse. I'll show you that in a second. But we're seeing headlines like this just came out today. Bloomberg, Americans about to pay even more at the grocery store. And of course we are, Paul, because we know this because, well, average price of ground beef, average, is now $7 a pound, right?
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's up from $4, so 75% increase.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, right? But here's why I say more. So Luke Groman put this together on TradingView.com. In the blue, we have what's called the Producer Price Index, and in the red, we have the Consumer Price Index, PPI. Leads CPI. So here we see the blue here started rising in 2021. Look, CPI like stayed flat for, gosh, 5-6 months and then followed. Yeah. And then the PPI turned down and CPI trundled on higher for a bit of time. And all that point is the PPI turns first, both up and down. Look at this turn. Woo.
That's dramatic.
You know what's coming?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
3-5 months, somewhere in that zone, CPI is going to turn up.
And the question is, looks like it's going to be just in time for the midterm elections, right? If that continues at that pace. And that's assuming that you can you know, defer the energy shock down a little bit further. So the question is they going to put all this effort into political outcomes that they don't get the outcome that they were looking for because inflation is the one event that finally really starts to hammer on people. You know, and I was thinking, Chris, you go back, you know, they tell us inflation's transitory. It's transitory, right? The rate of inflation might have been transitory because it dropped a little bit, but that chart that you showed earlier, it was not transitory. It's embedded policy at this point.
Nothing transitory about that. Nope.
That's consistent.
Yep. Transitory would look like this.
Yes.
It would come back down to 100, right? This is permanent. So, yeah, nothing transitory about that at all. Okay, let me pull this up. So, but look, Paul, if this says that in 2, 3, 4 months, we're going to be experiencing inflation, CPI inflation, about 6%, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to go higher still for all sorts of reasons, energy shock, this and that. But let's imagine just goes to 5%. I know that one of the things that I can't say for sure you're unique, but I've never run across anybody else who does this in your profession, where you take people's plans, their retirement plans, their portfolios, through a variety of scenarios, including things that I bet your colleagues would have yelled at you for out in the larger industry just a year or two ago, when you would take people through plans and said, let's look at 3.5% inflation, but also 5.5%. Oh, gosh, whoever plans for 5.5% inflation, that's crazy talk. It's not crazy talk anymore, is it?
No, it's not crazy talk. And the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, I had somebody in the industry tell me that I was being a fear monger by showing people what the impact of 5.5% inflation is. And, you know, I couldn't help it. I'm rarely spiteful, but I texted the other day and I was like, so am I fear mongering now or am I helping people prepare for possible outcomes? You know, and look, my argument is I would rather analyze your situation against 5.5% inflation, even if it never comes, so that you're aware and prepared to say, hey, look, there's no conservative way to protect yourself against inflation, right? If I run into somebody and they got, you know, $10 million and they live on $100,000 a year, 3.5% inflation, fine, right? You know, keep it all in bonds. You don't need to carry any more risk. Stay as conservative as you can possibly be. But the problem is the average person has not been able to accumulate enough assets to be able to live in that manner. So I have to prepare them and say, okay, look, you know, where you are now, assets that you have based on your income, you might can get away, you know, the ideal allocation based on the analysis, let's say is theoretically a 70% equity, 30% fixed income portfolio. But at 5.5% or higher inflation, you got to shed the bonds in that portfolio. There's no conservative way to protect yourself against that inflation. You've got to carry more risk. And if you're not at least mentally prepared, you know, my job is to help people prepare. Say, look, we don't have to do this now. But if we cross this threshold for this period of time, you've got a choice. You either absorb that inflation by reducing your lifestyle, if you can do that, or if you desire to do it, or you've got to work longer now to give yourself a little bit of a buffer, which most people don't want to or can't do that. Or you're going to have to carry more risk. And I don't want to do it, but you got to play the game by the rules that are forced upon you. So preparing people for that and helping them understand that impact. I mean, what's amazing to me is I don't even say it anymore, right? Is people look at it. And they're trying to formulate, used to I would kind of lead it, you know, but now I just wait. And people are trying to formulate their thought process when they see the impact of 5.5% inflation. And I just say, it's evil, isn't it? And they're like, yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I'm like, could you imagine if every citizen in the United States actually understood, you know, what is it? The media now says, if you say this, you got to have somebody come up there to say the other side. I'd love to get up there with that program when the Fed starts talking about their inflationary policies and say, here's the other side of the coin. If they continue this and we get 5.5% inflation, this is what your retirement income is going to be decimated by. Then the average person would rebel against it. But the problem is, inflation at least has been so slow and persistent, people just can't put their finger on why they're having to run harder and run harder and run harder, and their lifestyle just continues to get chipped away at. And the worst part is the people who don't have an adaptive strategy, the people who are like, I don't agree with passive, And I haven't met anybody that has an adaptive strategy that has some risk management overlay, so I'm just going to go park it over here all in the safest things that I can and get guarantees. It's just persistently wearing them, and they wake up 10 years later, and they're like, oh, no. And instead of making minor adaptations, they're having to make dramatic lifestyle changes. And that's the thing that I've seen in 28 years of doing this and retirement planning with people. It's real. It's consistent. And I even had a client the other day that, I guess, was this 2026, so 16 years ago, we stress tested them against 5.5% inflation. And they didn't have to take those increases, you know, immediately. But now they're to the point that they're actually having to jump. Their inflation hasn't been that much in their lifestyle, but because of other things that are hitting them in their life, they're having to jump up to the higher end of the budget. And they made the comment, hey, I'm glad we prepared for that, right? Because they're not full-on panic on top of all these other emotions they're having to deal with and the financial situation they've come to because of family events and things like that. At least they're better prepared mentally so that they've been able to think about it instead of having that panic moment where, you know, people get panicked. They either fight, flight, or freeze. And you can't, you know, fighting is the better option. You sure can't freeze. And the last thing you will do is go further in that other conservative direction because it's just going to make it a lot worse. And until, like now, I will say we run risk management. There's a time where you cross the line and you want to go full into those asset protected because cash is an asset class. And the greatest outcome that cash gives you is opportunity when other people don't have it because they're fully invested all the time and they have no money to take advantage of lower prices when they inevitably arise.
Paul, also, the other thing everybody's got to fight in this story is what we call gaslighting. When people tell you things that are just frankly untrue, Trump tweeted this out this morning. He said, the Trump administration has gotten costs down very substantially for the American consumer. There has never been anything like this. I'm going to laugh. I'm like, what could he even be talking about?
Oh my gosh.
Is he talking about gas or food? Or is it my property taxes? Or is it the insurance bills we just got the other? Which things exactly? What?
You know what I think happened? Is I really think with the UFO file disclosures, somebody gave him a window into an alternate reality to where he actually saw that happen. But
okay.
That is not in our reality.
Yeah, that's not different dimension. Yeah,
a completely different dimension. I mean, all I know to do is just put my hands over my face and go, how detached from reality can you absolutely be? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you have insider trading, you're making a couple of billion dollars on every tweet you send out. I mean, hey. I'm exaggerating there. Hey, yeah. What you're
probably
spending
probably only a couple hundred million, to be honest.
Yeah, a couple of hundred million is better than a couple billion. But yeah, I mean, how much you're spending as part of your net worth is lower because you had inside information, but that's not what the average person is seeing. I mean, it's not in health insurance, even though they try to tell us that. It's not in property and casualty insurance. It's certainly not in auto insurance. It's not in property taxes. It's not in beef prices. What am I missing? I haven't found anything that it's gone down in, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe some of the things you want. I've seen boat prices soften a little bit because I think people are having to make a choice to spend on the things they need more so than the things they want. And if this inflation continues, the things that people want are going to be depreciating assets again because there's only so much money to spend on the things that people need. And that's going to be different this time.
Yep. Well, the impact of all this inflation we've just been talking about, of course, is that one of the things you don't want, besides boats, when inflation's raging, is bonds. So the global long bond index yield rises to the highest since 2008. Paul, that's decades ago. That's decades ago, right? Well, almost two decades. And then when we look across long bond yields, we see here that the 30-year UK 30-year gilt in blue. We're going to draw this back to, we come down here. Oh, 1999. It's been a while, right? So, but again, look at that stark turnaround that just happened there. That's unbelievable. We've talked about it in the context of the 10-year where it was just going down, 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 down. Then there was this change in trend. Again, this change in trend is global, at least across the Western economies, as we're talking about it right here. Japan being a Western economy in this story. So this is remarkable. This is saying something to us that's very different from what we're hearing in the rest of the financial media, that everything must be great because stocks are going up, right?
Yeah.
So keep your eye on this, everyone.
I don't do a lot of presentations for it, and I tell people, look, our fixed income strategy or income strategy adapts. But just within the past month, we've had a major shift in our fixed income allocation.
Oh, really?
Because now, yeah, I mean, we've added short and intermediate term inflation protected securities because the weight of the evidence and all of our indicators says I'm not making this as advice for people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about within the context of our strategy, that we have to have exposure to that at this point, which has been quite some. I mean, I've used it in the past, but this is a major kind of shift in allocation that we've seen from that side. And I believe that the timing with the weight of the information is important. I really wanted to do it about 90 days earlier, but I have learned in the past 28 years, you wait till you actually cross that threshold and get that signal. Otherwise, you're speculating on an outcome, right? So that's a major change from our standpoint, is to reposition to, and inflation protected securities are not perfect, but they do a much better job of protecting your purchasing power on the fixed income side than just being locked in those longer term periods. And our duration being the length of time that you have in that portfolio has shortened dramatically, because in a higher inflationary environment, assuming the interest rates are honest and not manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Then, big assumption.
Then you want to be shorter on that time frame, because you're participating, assuming rates go up because of that inflation, quicker than being locked in. I mean, think about the poor folks that bought these 100-year bonds at 0% yield, or 20-30-year bonds at 1% and 2%. They're stuck. And they're going to have to wait a long time, right? Seesaw on the playground. Rates go up, principal goes down. The closer you get to that maturity, it will get to that par when it matures. But not only are you missing the income, if you're forced to sell, you're going to lose a lot of money in the interim period. That's why you're better to be shorter in your duration in a higher rate environment.
Yeah, I try to be kind, but I kind of lost my cool when I saw that the Argentinian 100-year 3.75% bonds were 8x oversubscribed. And I was just like, oh, you fools, you're going to lose your money bigly. I remember when that happened, I was like, Argentina? You realize they've defaulted like X times in the last 15 years. It's not even like once in a 100-year event. So crazy, crazy times. Paul, speaking of crazy times, I want to talk about this. We talked about it real quick, but we gotta get back to this really quick. So
yeah.
Listen, this is the larger context of like, where is all this money coming from? And you and I have learned a couple of things, particularly remember, so Elon Musk comes in and he finds all this stuff in Doge, just like it's awful. In January, it's just like F25, he's finding all this stuff. And then early February, he's gone, right? Nobody out, Trump hated him for a while, right? And I think it was because, in principle, because he got too close to something. This is by far, in financial economic terms, Paul, this is probably the most astonishing 30 seconds in all of podcast history. He's talking with Ted Cruz. I don't know who the other guy is. And it's Elon Musk. And this is way back. You can still see Doge is on the mantle over here. So he's still operating. And remember, as a reminder here, Elon made his money originally on PayPal. So if anybody understands payment systems, reconciliation systems, how computers and money come together, he probably has a pretty decent grounding in it, I would guess. Okay? All right. Let's listen in to this.
I mean, they're not totally wrong, but they're probably off by 5% or 10% in some cases. So I call it magic money computer, any computer which can just make money out of thin air. That's magic money.
So how does that work?
It just issues payments.
And you said there's something like 11 of these computers at Treasury that are sending out trillions in payments?
They're mostly at Treasury. Some are, but there's some at HHS, some at, there's one or two at states, there's some at DOD. I think we found now 14 magic money computers.
14, they, okay.
They just send money out of nothing.
They just send money out of nothing.
Still amazes me when I hear that. I was shocked when I heard it the first time.
Yeah.
And I'm still shocked when you hear it this time.
So I think we all deserve a follow-up question. I really need to know. Like, I don't think he misspoke. He was very clear. He didn't say magic money machines once accidentally. He defined it, said it three times. You know, he's like, hey, it just emits credits, right? That's what it does. It just emits credits. So this is how a banking system is supposed to work, right? So a company or individual is the payer. You write a check, right? It's going to get drawn off of your account. All right, you take this check and it goes over here, goes to somebody who's getting paid, could be a company or another individual. Hey, they put it in their bank. And then the bank goes, hey, you got through this clearinghouse to the paying bank. Do they have the funds here? Yes, they do. Okay, I'd like those funds. Here's my, okay, funds come in, funds land here. And so, but it always balances the T account in accounting. Debits on the left side of the account, credits on the right side, they balance to the penny. There's no leakage. You don't sometimes end up with more credits than debits, right? So, but Elon said that's not the case. He said there are these magic money machines. They just emit credit, is what he said. They don't also record debits. They just emit credits. So that's the magic money machine. It's just literally making money. And by the way, the thing that's most astonishing, even if they are somehow also doing the debit side, Paul, this is not how it's supposed to be. We've only given that power to one entity called the Federal Reserve. And then within this larger construct of a banking system, it all has to balance, because if it doesn't, what even is money in our system? What is money if you're not keeping an absolute 100% to the literally to the penny accounting of the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Even the Federal Reserve has to keep up with their balance sheet on what they're putting or purchasing in there. There's accounting from that standpoint. But the thing is I've heard people argue, like, oh, well, he doesn't really understand. One, you talked about the fact that he was in PayPal. He understands that. But two, he's an incredibly clear communicator, right? That's one thing about he says some wild things, but he's an incredibly good communicator. So you've got this loop system with credits and debits that goes within the banking system. But if you've got something that's just printing money and injecting in, the assumption is it's being accounted for on this side because everything else is. That's a completely dishonest system, right? Because that's a hidden inflationary feature that's within there for somebody else's own benefit that's lying about the reality of our money supply. And the only value that we have in our money since we've left the gold standard, pure fiat, right, is the faith that we have in it. And that's just going to continue to erode that faith if I believe him to be true in his statement. But I really want to know, and I think the American people should know what those are, and they should be removed immediately.
Maybe it helps us understand headlines like this. You know, the Pentagon fails financial audit for 8th year in a row. Yeah. You have a magic money machine, it's going to be pretty hard to pass an audit. I know there's other complexities, and it's just a hot mess of accounting over at the DOD, now DOW.
But he said the DOD had one of those,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
He said the DOD had one. So
yeah, I think he said at least
on
one.
Found. At least one.
Yeah. Remember, he was only poking around for like a month, and he found all this stuff. Can you imagine if he'd been poking around all year? You know, who knows what else we would have found?
Yeah.
But now it starts to make a little bit more sense, like, because, you know, you start asking questions that we should be able to resolve, like, where's all this money coming from? Where is it coming from? Well, if some of it's coming from magic money machines, and some of it's coming from this really on steroids basis trading stuff that's happening, and some of it's coming from all this leveraged stock market trading and other trading, and it's borrowing on borrowing to borrow more to borrow against borrowings and all the derivatives, it's a big giant thing. So I think I understand, Paul, why the keepers of the system, the Federal Reserve, at all, are just so terrified of letting anything begin to correct. Because I think they're afraid that you'll get into that Warren Buffett situation, tide goes out, you find out a whole lot of people been swimming naked, right? Whole swaths of the system are just buck naked. You know, I think that's the concern, is like you can't let reality begin to get its nose under the tent here, because it just won't turn out well, I guess. Could explain it.
Right. Well, I mean, a dishonest system is going to collapse at some point in the future. So the question is, it can last a whole lot longer than anybody could possibly imagine. But we're not going to get out of this without consequences. The truth always comes out in the end. That's one thing. You know, the truth will stand the test of time.
We should talk about this then, because, you know, one of the consequences of all this money printing is you end up with a tale of two worlds. It's the haves and the have-nots. And astonishing chart came out in Financial Times just the other day here, and we've noted this base data before, at least in terms of the top 10%. I didn't have the bottom 80% at the time, so now we've got it. Almost mirror images of each other. As the top 10% has gained, the bottom 80% has lost. And so now, top 10% of U.S. earners account for half of all consumer spending, just the top 10%. The bottom 80%, I'm just going to squint at that and call that 37%. This is an ugly chart, Paul. This is really ugly. This is
That's the horrific.
Abandonment of your entire middle class. The bottom 80% completely abandoned by policies. The Fed policies of just keeping financial markets well bid at all times. That this is no way to run a society.
And unfortunately, what happens is that top 10% continues to get peeled into a feedback loop, right? Like one of the things I mentioned to kids when they were young, and somebody else gave me the advice is like, you know, be careful who you're spending your free time with, right? Because if you're you know, trying to travel with somebody that makes 10 times the income you do, you're either going to go bankrupt trying to keep up with them, or they're going to pay for you and they're going to despise you. So what happens is that 10% just continues to get concentrated around each other, and they're so detached from the reality of the average person because they're just not running into them, right? They're not seeing them at the high-end restaurants. They're not seeing them drive necessarily the same cars and lifestyles and vacations. And we've got this just bifurcated society where the large majority are struggling. And because their wages haven't gone up with the asset price inflation, they're weaker than they've ever been before. And if they make a financial mistake, it sets them back 10 years and they're never able to catch up. I mean, it's just absolutely horrific what we're doing to the average person and our next generation.
It is. And here's an obvious consequence of that. Consumer sentiment versus stocks. Stocks never higher. Consumer sentiment never lower. So this chart compares to the one we just saw before. But this is really, I mean, it's just very much almost a let them eat cake moment. Like, oh, you know, Trump comes out and says, oh, look at me. I'm such a great president. Stocks have never been higher. And of course, if you're the president of the entire country, this chart should be very concerning. Never lower.
Yeah.
But of course, why would the bottom 80% feel okay about things, right?
Yeah.
They've just been getting, you know, slowly squeezed out. But this is astonishing, Paul. It used to be that we called poverty if you were in the bottom third of society. Now, apparently, it's if you're in the bottom 80%, right? You are just falling behind further and further every year. And now we know that, right? So that this is how we make sense of all those headlines, right? You know, two-thirds of families are one paycheck away from disaster or have $500 in the bank or something like that. You're like, how can that be? There it is. Mm-hmm. In one ugly chart.
And I wish I could remember the statistics, but I do know that we reached an extreme in 1929 where the top 10%, let's say it was more than that, controlled the large majority of the wealth. Well, after the Great Depression, that rebalanced out a lot, you know, and some say after World War II, the 50s and 60s were kind of the real heyday for the American family and the middle class, because I believe then that, you know, 50% of the country, guys, this may be wrong, but 50% of the country owned something like 80% of the wealth. And that's where, you know, you can have a mechanic that's working and wife stays at home and still live a middle class lifestyle. And we're now to the point that unless you're an asset holder, you're priced out of the large majority of what's traditionally been known as the American lifestyle. And the generation that has benefited from all these policies just can't understand, because they haven't walked the path that the younger generation is today. And I'm a full believer that what is it? I always get this wrong. You can empathize or sympathize, whichever one that is. You can sympathize with somebody, but you can't empathize with them. I think I got that right. Unless you've walked the path that they've walked, right? Mm-hmm. Like if somebody lost a child, I can sympathize, but I've never lost a child. If somebody that's lost a child can empathize with somebody that's lost, because they've walked that path. And, you know, we're in a situation where a whole generation is not even trying to sympathize, because they're assuming that their experience was the same that this generation has, and if you just, you know, make this sacrifice here and there, and it's a completely different environment. Unfortunately, it's blinding those asset holders and policymakers to the reality of what's happening in our country and the destruction that's bringing and the despair that it's bringing, demoralization, as you say, to the younger generations.
And we're watching some of these dialogues begin to unfold. You know, boomers, millennials, they're having these sort of conversations. And it's astonishing that, like, they're having, I hesitate to call them conversations, Paul, because they're just speaking in different, like, they're different, totally different frames of reference, right? So I think that's a great distinction you make. So the boomers are not empathizing. In some cases, they're not even sympathizing, right? Because, you know, as we've talked about before, 40 years of declining interest rates is a tailwind, you know? There's some wiggles and jiggles along there. Of course, everybody has to work hard, take risks, all of that. But it's a fundamentally, the dice are loaded in your favor if you're an asset accumulator when interest rates are on a declining spectrum. Totally different world when they're going the other direction. 100%, just completely different. But, you know, I had a grandmother who's still in, when she died in the mid-90s, But to her very end, she would save the string off of roasts, you know, and wash them carefully, keep them in a drawer. In case she needed string, she would take the labels off of soup cans in case she needed to write a list to the grocery store on them, which she did. She was formed by the Great Depression. That thing was over for most of her life, but it formed her worldview, you know. And so I think that's what we're seeing with the boomers. They just have a worldview that got formed, and they're just locked into that. That's how the world works. You know, why don't you see it this way? I know that's how the world works because I walked that path. That's how it works. And you got the young people like, no, that's not how it works. Totally not that world. Yeah.
Well, and you know, and another thing, think about it, and people tend to forget this. I was having a conversation with a client that I've worked with for a long time, and I was like, so, you know, they had shared that they had made some mistakes financially and kind of learned from those mistakes. I'm like, so how did you get out of the situation? I knew the answer, but, you know, bought a house, interest rates were real high, interest rates started coming down, and then they had a mistake that they made that cost them a lot of money. Well, you know what? They refinanced the house at lower rates, kept the same payment. Yeah, they tied it back up in there, and then they made another mistake when interest rates were lower. They refinanced the house, kept the same payment because interest rates were lower, and then didn't make those mistakes again, right? Mm-hmm. So they were okay. So built-in lower interest rates was kind of a bailout with the asset price inflation that occurred. You know, and then we had a conversation. I'm like, so what happens if you're a young kid and you bought a house at 2.5%, interest rates are 5.5, 6, 7, wherever they are now in the 30-year mortgage, and you make a financial mistake? Well, that's a completely different set of consequences. If the only thing that you have to do is refinance that equity within the house, right, your payment's going up. So you're still going to, you know, so you're losing more capital when wages aren't keeping up where it is. It's just a completely different environment. It was a lot easier to get bailed out with that tailwind of asset price inflation and rates going down. But now we've got these inflationary pressures where rates should go up to help stamp that out. We should have quantitative tightening, and you're helping the asset owners, but you're just making it far more dangerous for the individuals that are trying to accumulate assets, because now any financial mistake sets you back instead of you know, kind of accumulating your debt and using that equity and lower interest rates to keep the same payment. It's just the environment we're in.
Well, I agree, and I think that for anybody who wants to, you know, manage their money well so they can grow it, or figure out how you're going to have some left behind to leave for your progeny and offspring, please come to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a very simple form, and you will begin the process then of getting on Paul's calendar, his schedule, or his team to begin to have these conversations. I think this is a generational regime change. King dollar, interest rates reversing, this energy shock, really big, big things happening. And of course, you need a plan for that. So I invite everybody again, peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out the form, get the process started. You will not regret it. I pretty much can guarantee that. It's a great process.
I have found it and had feedback that it's very beneficial for people, whether we work together or not, right? My argument is if we can help better educate you so you know why you own what you own, you know why you need to be allocated of where you are. Jordan Peterson said if you can show somebody the why, they can handle the how. What I'm finding is so many people don't understand the why of how they're allocated, and they need to know that, and that's what our process is designed to help them go through that.
Well, Paul, thank you for your time today. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week.
Good to see you, Chris.